The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to this recording of the American College of Osteopathic Internists Internal Medicine Board Review Course. The course was held in Baltimore at the Marriott Waterfront Hotel on May 8th through 12th, 2019. The course featured nationally known speakers covering a wide variety of topics of importance to the internist preparing for initial certification or for recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Anemia is presented by Dr. Cheryl Kowalski.
Good morning. Thank you so much for being here today, especially at 7 o'clock in the morning, and supporting the ACOI with this educational session. I think and I hope that you will find a lot of benefit out of it. When I give this, we have no idea the questions that are on your boards, except from when we took the boards. And so I hope that you find this of value. If we've missed the mark, please let us know if there's some issues or areas that we didn't do well. I also try to present my lectures toward the primary care internist and hospitalist, so hopefully you'll find some value in the workup that we talk about over the next several hours. So we're going to talk about anemia this first lecture. And it's helpful to define terms. I usually use a hemoglobin of less than 13, but there's a lot of hospital labs, mine included, that it's 12 for a woman and 12 and a half for a man. So those are some things you just need to kind of watch what your lab says. But there's some things that I disagree with. I'll talk about down the road. So when you're thinking about working up an anemia, is this a little loud? Things that can help direct your workup is looking at your MCV and your retic count. But those are only kind of guidelines, but can kind of give you some help in directing what you're going to do. So let's start with microcytic anemias. So first of all, the most important thing is to obtain and interpret iron studies. And one thing I want you to take with you the rest of your life in your career is just because a person's anemic doesn't mean they're iron deficient. So don't tell the old lady you're anemic, so take some iron, or anybody else. Give them the benefit of a workup. So you've got to interpret those iron studies, and sometimes it can be hard because some people have a true iron deficiency and some people have a chronic disease that can kind of mimic that. So you have to kind of look at that. And then the ferritin makes that even harder because sometimes it can be elevated or even normal and they could truly have an iron deficiency. So sometimes it can be a little difficult. So it's thought that this is the most common nutritional problem in the world, and even here in the United States, because of all the different issues that we're going to talk about. First, you have to have an intact bowel, and you have to have an intact stomach. Think about all your patients that are have a bariatric surgery or other bowel or gastric surgery for whatever reason. Also, the iron can, the absorption can be delayed by food, just in general, but especially people who are eating a lot of bran and those that are drinking a lot of tea. That would be black tea. So think about the reasons that people are iron deficient. So we got to think about blood loss, which is, of course, the most common reason, but then decreased intake and increased utilization, and then malabsorption. So these are some of the symptoms that you see in our office. Our staff can pretty much pick out the new patients that are coming in for iron deficiency or the old patients who aren't returning for their appointments because they just can't think clearly. And they're not just fatigue, but irritable. You can have pica, but that's not as common. But the ice chewers are the biggest thing. I've had patients that have ruined their teeth because they chew so much ice. So this is what an iron deficiency can look like. So you have more of a central pallor of your red blood cells, and they can be a variety of sizes, but generally overall they're small. Your MCV is usually low, and percent saturation is usually less than 20%. If it's over 20%, that's when you have to start thinking about chronic disease. So the first thing you always have to do is look for a GI or a blood loss source. And it can be GI, and it can be, of course, GU, heavy menses, young women who aren't eating properly and have heavy periods. Think about the regular blood donor. Wherever patients go to donate blood, the regular blood donors are very proud to be in the Gallon Club, but those places that take their blood never tell those people to tell your doctor you're a regular blood donor. And I've had lots of patients come in that are profoundly iron deficient, and their GI workup is negative, and find out they're in the Gallon Club and have never been told that they need to supplement with iron. And that should be under your direction, so you know what's going on, so you can be watching to see, because that can mask a GI issue too. So the standard right now still is ferrous sulfate, 325 milligrams. There's a variety of different products. It does not need to be prescribed. It's over the counter. Usually I start them on one a day to see if they have any problems tolerating it, and then increase to twice a day. They can't take all of them at the same time because the body can only absorb so much, and so we space it out throughout the day. If they're profoundly iron deficient, it could take 6 to 12 months of taking it three times a day to replace it. And if they're still losing blood, like heavy menses or some type of GI issue, Crohn's disease or whatever, they may need to be on iron supplementation indefinitely until that problem is fixed, if it is possible. And some of those have to be on IV iron replacement because they just can't absorb it or can't take enough oral supplement to compensate for the amount of blood loss that they're having. So sideroblastic anemias are also considered microcytic, and there's a defect involving the incorporation of the iron into the heme structure, and so you have these ringed sideroblasts that you can see in the bone marrow. Causes of this are usually acquired. It's considered to be one of the myelodysplastic categories. There are reversible ones, such as alcohol intake, the use of INH or chloramphenicol, and then lead poisoning. So the treatment is generally supportive, fix the underlying issue. You can supplement them with pyridoxine. The ones that are myelodysplasia usually may be candidates for stem cell transplant. And erythropoietin supplementation may be of benefit for some of them. So thalassemia is also a microcytic anemia, and it's probably the most profound microcytic anemia. If you see someone with a MCV of less than 70, really put that for sure in your differential diagnosis. So you can have beta thalassemia or alpha thalassemia, and with beta thalassemia, both of them, there's decreased synthesis of that particular globulin chain. The beta thalassemia, however, is diagnosed by hemoglobin electrophoresis, while alpha thalassemia is not diagnosed that way, and you need to do a genetic study with the alpha thalassemia gene probe. So this is what these look like. So as opposed to iron deficiency, where you had that central pallor, these have the target cells. So you can look at that those cells, and they have a bullseye. And their variety, they're not uniform in their production either. So when you're working up beta thalassemia, there's three different types. There's the trait. Usually those are not an issue. There's the intermedia. Some of these may start needing transfusions. And then there's the major, or Cooley's anemia. And those have all those problems that you can see with thalassemia problems. So they have many different types of genotypes, and so the diagnosis is sometimes really hard to quantify or qualify. And sometimes there can be crossovers between sickle cell and thalassemia as well. So this is what some of the more profound thalassemias can look like with the remodeling of the bones and the different deformities that you can see and all the different issues that can go along with thalassemia. And so alpha thalassemia, you can just have the silent carrier where you just see a microcytosis, and that's just one alpha gene missing, on down to the trait where there's two genes missing, and the hemoglobin H disease or Bart's where there's three genes missing, and of course the one you always think about is the hydrops fetalis, which is not compatible with life. So again, I've seen patients treated for anemia with iron, and that's the biggest mistake that you can make, but especially with thalassemia, they have that profound microcytosis, and oh, we've got iron deficiency, and iron levels are not obtained. And I would say one thing about obtaining iron levels, sometimes they can be really hard to get accurate ones. The patients really need to have their lab work done fasting, very, very important, without having taken iron or any vitamins that morning. And it really is best to have them drawn at a hospital so they're not sitting waiting for the courier to pick up at your drawing station, because some of the iron can leach out if there's any type of lysis of those red blood cells and give you an artificially elevated iron level. Just stress to your patients the importance of fasting and where they get it done. So normochromic normocytic anemia, also known as anemia of chronic disease, and this is just a hyperproliferative anemia, so the body is sick for whatever that underlying chronic disease is. And so I tell patients, so people, you know, you feel sick, you feel tired from whatever it is, and so does the bone marrow. The bone marrow is an organ too, and it just suppresses that bone marrow from working as well. There can also be decreased survival time, decreased erythropoietin supplementation or response of the bone marrow to the erythropoietin. And the iron isn't mobilized, and that's why you can sometimes see a low iron level, because it's not mobilized properly to the bone marrow for use. But then you'll see an elevated ferritin and a low TIBC. So like I said, it sometimes can be confusing to try to interpret it. So these are the ones we most often think of. So infectious, malignant, inflammatory, traumatic. So inflammatory, all your rheumatoid patients, the infectious patients like osteomyelitis, that type of thing. Think about those patients. So first, when you're working it up, you have to give them the benefit of the workup, exclude other etiologies. And the older the person gets, the more it is that more things affect anemia. So it's not just one cause. There may be multifactorial causes. Think about the elderly person. Their albumin is low. Their B12 is low because they're not eating right. Their iron could be low. They have rheumatoid arthritis. So many things. And some of those things can be fixed to maximize their anemia. And so they deserve the benefit of a full workup. So this is a little cartoon that kind of shows you. The middle one is how iron is absorbed normally, and it just comes in. Your liver is making a normal amount of hepcidin, and you have those little blue things called the ferroportin, and they're the gatekeepers, and then the hepcidin comes there and kind of regulates how much iron comes in. While on the left, the anemia of chronic disease, you've got lots of hepcidin, and so it won't allow as much of the iron to come in to be used. And on the opposite side, on the right, you've got hemochromatosis, where there's little or no hepcidin being made. And so the body's just overwhelmed with this influx of iron. So the therapy is, again, treat the underlying cause and then correct any deficiency, and select patients might benefit from erythropoietin, but you have to be very careful. There's very stringent rules that insurance companies have, and I would suggest sending your patients to a hematologist so you don't get the big bill for the erythropoietin that you've given them. So, macrocytic anemia. So, generally, it's characterized by abnormal nuclear maturation of the red cell precursors. So, people think about B12 deficiency, folate deficiency. Chemotherapy, as you know, can do that. Myelodysplasia and monoclonal protein. So, for B12 absorption, you have to have all these things intact. So you have to have an intact stomach that's actively making acid and pepsin, and you have to have working parietal cells that are actually producing intrinsic factor. You have to have an intact duodenum and terminal ileum. So one of the main causes you think of is a dietary lack, but the other things you gotta think about is how many of your patients are on antacids regimen. So if they are, that's gonna decrease the proteolysis, and then you're gonna have issues with B12 deficiency as well as iron deficiency. Think about deficiencies of intrinsic factors. So you've had a gastrectomy or bariatric surgery. Those patients are rarely told by the surgeon that they will most likely, probably 95%, require B12 and iron supplementation the rest of their life. And so 4, 5, 6 years go by, their levels aren't checked, they show up profoundly iron deficient or anemic, and then you find all these deficiencies that have to be corrected. And I would say also vast majority of those who are iron deficient require IV replacement. So other things that you could think about, pernicious anemia, which I try to tell my patients, everybody thinks pernicious anemia is the B12 deficiency, but it's just one of many, as you can see here. So other things you gotta think about, I put two at the top that are the most common ones that you're gonna see. The rest are kind of rare. I don't know if any of us ever see some of those throughout their career. But think of all your patients that are metformin, and think of those who may be having HIV or H. pylori. A lot of our patients have that too. So we also think of the results of B12 deficiency as more than just anemia, but we have all the different neurological problems that you can see. So this is a picture of B12 deficiency. And if you look at right in the, kind of in the middle, you see a small lymphocyte, and the red blood cells should be about that size, but you can see there's a lot of red blood cells that are bigger than that. There's also a segmented neutrophil, and usually segmented neutrophils should have 3 to 5 segments, and if they have more, then you gotta think of B12 deficiency. I also thought an interesting thing is that the neuropsych symptoms can predate the hematological changes. So you can get these tests. I don't really know of the benefits, so if you're trying to be cost-containing, I don't think you really need the methylmalonic acid. Homocysteine levels could be a benefit for a variety of reasons. If their B12 is low, they need supplementation. Our neurology colleagues tell us that a B12 below 300 increases your risk of peripheral neuropathies. And so many of our labs have a normal level of 220. or even 180. It's not going to hurt these patients to be on B12 supplementation. You can't overdose on them. And so I try to supplement them to get them above 300. If you're thinking about pernicious anemia, these are the tests you might want to get. Most of these fancy tests now require pre-authorization, and so your staff has to struggle through, and you may have to get a one-on-one line and still get denied for testing of these. So the oral is still adequate if they've had bariatric surgery, some other surgery where they're not absorbing. Sublingual can work well in most patients. Your office probably is not getting reimbursed to purchase B12 or to give the injection, so you need to teach them how to give their own injections and write the prescription. Folate deficiency, most common cause is dietary. Also, we have the increased requirements, such as in pregnancy or intestinal malabsorption issues. So what do we get, the serum folate or the RBC folate? My understanding is the RBC folate is a more expensive test. They both have their issues, so it should be done fasting. Again, it's a B vitamin that you can't overdose on, and I feel like that's somebody who's folate level is less than 6 deserves the benefit of supplementation. So 1 milligram is adequate, but that's prescription. You can put these patients on 400 or 800 micrograms over the counter, and they'll be just fine. So let's talk about one of our favorites, hemolytic anemia, which makes everybody's eyes cross. So two different mechanisms. So extravascular hemolysis, so this happens in the liver or the spleen, or actually intravascular, where the RBCs are lysed in circulation. So two main causes. So there can be red blood cell defects, so that's inherited, or the extracorpuscular causes that are always acquired. So in the hereditary ones, we think of the enzyme defects, membrane defects, and hemoglobinopathies and thalassemias. And in the acquired, we think of immune hemolytic anemia, splenomegaly, not so much, microangiopathic hemolytic anemia, which you might see once in your lifetime at PNH, the same. Malaria and clostridia, again, you may never see. Sparse cell anemia, I don't think I've ever seen. So diagnosis, so you get your corrected reticulocyte count, and if it's greater than 2, put that in your differential. You also have to remember if there's a brisk blood loss, your retic count is going to be up as well. So they're going to have, these patients will have elevated indirect bilirubin, elevated LDH, and their haptoglobin will be low or absent. So if you look at their urine, the hemosiderin will be present only when it's intravascular hemolysis. So if you think about that, if there's hemolysis in the spleen, there's not going to be urine hemosiderin in the blood and then into the urine. And so then you may get a dipstick positive for blood, but you may not see any on when you're doing a microscopic exam. So these have the antibodies that are destroying these red blood cells piece by piece. So they kind of have an abnormal shape, but they don't look ragged. So your direct Coombs or direct antiglobulin is useful in diagnosing the autoimmune hemolytic anemia. And it's positive when there's antibody coating the patient's red blood cells. I have a little cartoon that makes it a little bit easier. And then the indirect looks for antibodies in the serum. So the top one is the direct Coombs or direct antiglobulin test. And so you have these red blood cells of the patient that have a coating of antibody on them. And then you put your reagent, that's an anti-AHG, add it to it, and if it glutinates, you have a positive test. So the bottom is indirect. You have antibodies in the patient's serum, and you use a reagent, erythrocyte, and you mix it, and if you have agglutination, then you know you have antibodies in your serum. So autoimmune hemolytic anemia, most of it is idiopathic, and so it happens when antibody binds or complements the red cell membrane. So the warm antibody autoimmune hemolytic anemia, so it's reactive at 37 degrees C. So you can have the IgG, or you may have the C3 on the antibodies. Again, most of it is idiopathic, and it can be a complication of an underlying disease. So some of these include chronic lymphocytic leukemia or collagen vascular diseases, ulcerative colitis, or congenital immunodeficiency. The treatment has been the same standard for years. Prednisone, 1 milligram per kilogram per day for about 2 weeks. You should really start seeing an improvement in a few days. Folic acid is usually supplemented. Splenectomy used to be the treatment of choice when they were refractory to prednisone. In fact, you gave them 3 weeks of prednisone. If they didn't respond, you did a splenectomy. That's not so much anymore since we have many other immunosuppressive drugs and immunoglobulin and Rituxan. So sometimes these patients will need a transfusion, and you'll get a call from your lab is that we can't find a perfect match. You'll never find a perfect match, but you'd use the least incompatible blood. So we got cold antibody. So again, idiopathic. Again, chronic lymphocytic leukemia, so it could be cold or warm. And you always think of mycoplasma infection and infectious mononucleosis, paroxysmal cold, hemoglobinuria. So avoid cold exposure. The vast majority of your patients will be out shoveling snow without gloves. Again, supplement their folic acid. And the big thing is treat the underlying disorder if there is one. You can use immunosuppressive agents. And in this case, splenectomy isn't really that helpful. So transfusions of packed cells, you have to do the compatibility testing at 37 degrees. So when these patients come in for lab, your lab needs to be aware that they have this cold antibody. They have to draw the patient and run the test immediately. So they have to go to a hospital to have their blood work done. And once the lab is aware that this patient has this issue, they'll work with them to get it done. Otherwise, it's going to coagulate and you can't do your tests. So PNH, so that's an acquired stem cell issue where you have a defective production of the GPI anchor protein, and only a portion of the red blood cells are affected. But the interesting thing is that all your cell lines can be affected. So it can be undiagnosed for a long period of time because this patient has this history of chronic hemolysis, hemoglobinuria, pancytopenia, and you're thinking of a lot of other things when you're thinking of pancytopenia as well as thrombotic events. But when you have that pancytopenia and thrombotic events, kind of put that in the back of your mind. This isn't that common, so you're not thinking of it that often. So these patients will have a low haptoglobin, but increased LDH, just like a classic hemolytic anemia, and they won't have the hemoglobinuria or hemosiderinuria either. So this can be found also in a setting of aplastic anemia or myelodysplasia. And then the weird one is there can be no hemolysis either, but the pancytopenia and thrombotic events. So this is diagnosed by a specific flow cytometry. You can't just order a flow cytometry. It has to be specific, and it has to be stated that you're looking for PNH and you're looking for antibodies directed against the GPI anchor protein. So treatment, again, is supportive. Folic acid, corticosteroids, transfuse as needed. Be careful with iron supplementation. anticoagulate with warfarin and stem cell transplant. I kind of skipped over Soliris there because it's very rare that a patient should need that. That will cost at least about $120,000 a year for treatment of a patient, and most of them don't need it. So non-immune hemolytic anemia, so we got to think about our inherited things, such as red blood cell membrane disorders, hereditary spherocytosis, elliptocytosis, stomatitosis. Most of those are rare. I think I've seen one of the ellipto and one of stomato in my career. The spherocytosis is more common, and of course your G6PD deficiency. So with the hereditary spherocytosis, there's a defect in the proteins in the red blood cell cytoskeleton. So they are not made properly. So instead of being like a donut, they're more like a sphere. And so because there's that defect, they're more fragile. And so they can degrade a lot faster. So most of them are just mild to that you don't need to have anything done. You'll see the spherocytes on peripheral smear, and this should be at least 30% of your red blood cells. You can do the increased osmotic fragility test to make this diagnosis. And the important thing is that they can develop an aplastic crisis when there's a viral infection, so they get really sick. They're trying to make all these extra cells, and just like with sometimes with sickle cell, they can get that, so they can get that with this as well. And splenectomy is the treatment of choice for severe cases. I had one patient come in and tell me that in the 70s, every family member had a splenectomy because one person was diagnosed with spherocytosis. So this is what those cells look like. You can see that they're smaller next to those segmented neutrophils, which are usually 10 to 12 microns across. The red blood cells should be about 6, and you can see it's probably more like 3 or 4. So G6PD deficiency is the most common enzyme deficiency in the world, and there's all different levels of it. So again, all different pictures when you're looking at it. The things that you need to remember is the drugs it's associated with, and there is a long list, but this is the most common. Primaquine, sulfa, dapsone, nitrofurantoin, sulfa being the most common drug that we use. And then this is, they love this for the boards. What will a person ingest that can cause acute hemolysis shortly thereafter, and that's fava beans. So the acute hemolysis usually lasts 2 to 4 days when it happens. It's just usually supportive. Triggers can be infections, diabetic ketoacidosis. You'll see these bite cells on Heinz bodies, which I'll show you in a second. And so you make the diagnosis by the level of G6PD, but don't do it in the acute time because all those cells are lysing and what little G6PD they have is now in the serum, and so it can actually give you a normal test. So you have to do them when they're in a steady state. So these are the bite cells. It actually looks like a bite, and that's what you think of all hemolytic anemia should look like, but it doesn't. And then the special stain can show those little Heinz bodies, which is precipitated hemoglobin. So going over to our hemoglobinopathies, we think of sickle cell. So there's a defect in the globulin chain synthesis, and you make the diagnosis with a hemoglobin S of greater than 50%. And that is very important, and I'll tell you in a second why. So there's multiple genotypes and phenotypes, and again, I said you can have that sickle thal trait, genetic change as well. So sickle cell trait is not a disease, so those are diagnosed with a hemoglobin S of less than 50%. Don't let that get you sucked in when you're treating a patient and they say they have sickle cell anemia and they're drug seekers. So the top shows the normal red blood cells kind of just going through the vasculature, and a cross-section of showing you what the normal hemoglobin looks like. And then here's the sickle cell, which are more rigid, and they can't bend as well, so they don't slide through the tiny capillaries as well. And so they cause a blockage, so you're not having oxygen on the other side of that blockage. And so that gives you your ischemic issue. So painful episode is the most common thing. The others are a lot less common that we have here and that you think about. Hemolysis, that chronic hemolysis, causes all those problems. Usually these people end up needing cholecystectomies at a young age. Aplastic crisis can be a real issue. They can develop osteopenia, and of course anemia. I don't know why I even put that on the slide. And nutritional deficiencies. So they require general good care. Back when I was going to school, and there's some of you that are my age, Demerol was the drug of choice in hospital for everything, and it's a very poor pain drug. And so I think the hospitals usually only have this in their stock for treatment of Rigers, and it's a great drug for that. So most people are getting IV morphine or Dilaudid. These patients, the vast majority, should be on hydroxyurea. We transfuse them to keep them at their baseline. So if their baseline is 6, we just transfuse them to keep them up there. We can do exchange transfusions on these patients if they're not responsive to hydrea, and we just schedule them for every 4 to 6 weeks they come in for an exchange transfusion. And then stem cell transplant is kind of on the rise in the children. Aplastic anemia, it's pure, you can have 3 different things. Either just the red blood cells, which is pure red cell aplasia, bicytopenia, or pancytopenia. And it's essentially is bone marrow failure. So it can be congenital, but the most common is acquired or secondary to other issues that are listed there. And to make this diagnosis, you need to have a bone marrow biopsy. Usually when we do bone marrow biopsy, we only do 1, maybe 2 cores. But if you're suspicious for this, you usually need to get 4 to 5 cores, because all of them have to show hypocellularity, because you can, with just one, have some sampling error. And then we also do flow cytometry and cytogenetics, because it may not be aplastic anemia. It could be a rare variant of myelodysplasia. So the top left is a normal bone marrow. So usually in normal people, up to the age of 60 or so, about half our bone marrow is fat. As we get older, the cellularity does drop to maybe 40, 35, 30%. But at the bottom, you can see how there's very little hematopoietic tissue there, and that's what aplastic anemia looks like. So the treatment is antithymocyte globulin, which we've been using for decades. And then cyclosporin was added about 20 years ago as well. And most of these patients, if they are, they're candidates for stem cell transplant.